Hey, time for another DraftPhysics.com video presentation. Debate physics also, but we still can't find a debater. Alright, anyway, so this is a Kathy Loves Physics and History video, and I think I've played it before, but I'll play it again. And it's almost impossible for me not to argue that most of the physics that is argued to be correct in the video is not really correct. And so this is the story of how you really make a mess out of physics, not the story of how physics got the right answer. It's really, the history just points out how you can make these mistakes, like honest ones, like Benjamin Franklin assigning plus and minus wrong. He took a guess and he guessed wrong. He had a 50-50 chance, man, he blew it. And then they never fixed it. And then they just convoluted everything on top of it to correct for the fact that they never fixed, which is a wrong concept. So the history of energy has more than one wrong concept in it. And the right concepts were, they had them and then they threw them away. So that's kind of the irony of it, is that it's not only the story about them making corrections to things that weren't broken. And that's the part that's really strange. It's one thing to guess wrong. It's another thing to decide to change something that works just fine. And that's what they did to Descartes and Newton and Galileo, is to say all of their right answers didn't mean anything. They weren't getting right answers for a good reason, and decided to change the foundation upon which they got the right answers, which was really a big mistake. All right, so she calls this the history of the concept of energy. I don't think that's what it is, the concept of energy. You can't start in the middle. That's cheating. And she did that, I guess, because it's a woman, and therefore we have to highlight the one little piece of the story and blow it way out of proportion. Well, she was significant, but not significant in any good way, so that's the fundamental argument. She proved a theory that was wrong, just on its face, and it was in the wrong direction. So she was pointing in the wrong direction and got an answer that was really, really wrong, and then physics made it less wrong. So it's only half in the wrong direction. But they never fixed it. All right, so then she titles it First Law of Thermodynamics, which is the Descartesian statement. I mean, Descartes wasn't the first person to say it, but was the first person to really say it with some sort of authority, that the energy is just in the system, that the universe is created and has so much movement in it, and the movement just moves through the system. And the movement never stops moving, it just changes who's moving. So it goes from little bits moving fast to big bits moving slow. But when you add it all up, when you take the $10,000 bills, the fast movement, and the $1 bills, the slow movement, there's always the same amount of currency or energy in the universe. And these people really didn't have anything to do with that. Yeah. So that history, again, was already stated. It was already a concept, and it got lost in, the math people. Anyway, history of the concept of energy. Okay, like I said, it's not really the concept of energy. It's how to get wrong answers. It's how to do crappy science, frankly. And that's all this history illustrates, is how to get wrong answers and not do very good physics.
I would like to begin in the early 1700s with a remarkable woman named Emily du Châtelet.
Okay, let's say she's remarkable in the sense of the times, but she knew some languages, got some education. She was sort of treated as a useful citizen, and wasn't obliged to, just be a common housewife.
Emily was born in 1706, and she was the only daughter of a wealthy and connected...
So, only daughter, it almost sounds like that was all they had. They had plenty of sons, three or four.
French family. She was brilliant in mathematics and languages from an early age. Her father lamented, quote...
I think she had a little brother, and that was the key to her getting educated, is because they wanted to educate the younger brother, the little one. they threw her in also. So it's pretty much because of her younger brother that she got educated.
Well, my youngest flaunts her mind and frightens away all the suitors. We just...
Okay, so the brother was a little bit older. Okay, same difference, right? The one son was getting tutored. So since they're bringing in tutors to tutor him, figured she might as well get some free tutoring also.
Don't know what to do with her. Her father was exaggerating, of course, because with beauty, money, and high social status, there are plenty of men who are willing to look past her unusual intelligence. When she turned 18, she decided she didn't want to be forced to live in a convent, like most unmarried upper-class women were at the time, and agreed to an arranged marriage to a 34-year-old.
So it's a pretty dismal fact, you know, that women were obliged to be just sold off, and, you know, so she really didn't have any choices. I don't think she was facing the convent, frankly. You can say that, but I don't think she was going to be obliged.
...year-old Marquis. They had 3 children in quick succession, and afterwards had what can only be described as an open marriage. In 1733...
It seems that you could argue the whole marriage thing was for the purpose of just doing this spawning thing to, you know, create heirs to your fortunes and all of that kind of crap, and that didn't really have anything to do with anything pure of heart.
Emily met the poet Voltaire, and they immediately fell in love. Voltaire was always in trouble with the French government for pushing for freedom of religion and speech and satirizing the religious and secular leaders of the day. In fact, when he met Emily, he was still a little bit in trouble, having just returned from exile in England, where he learned about Newton's philosophies. Soon, Emily...
Technically, he's just a writer, okay? He's a good writer, all right? So he becomes a mouthpiece for, you know, different agendae. And some of that agendae was science, but not a scientist.
Emily, her husband, and her lover Voltaire decide to hole up at her country home called Surrey. Emily wrote a friend, quote, "There is heroism, or perhaps madness, in my shutting myself up at Surrey with the 3 of us." Emily du Châtelet and Voltaire then created an Academy of Sciences with over 21,000 books, larger than most universities at the time.
Just another way of just taking the point that these are just these aristocrats that the, you know, French finally had to cut off all their heads. So these aren't exactly charming people. They're living very privileged lives in a country where most of the people are living dismal, grisly, horrible lives.
In 1738, they started to collaborate on a book on Newton, where Emily did most of the math and Voltaire wrote most of the prose. Or as he put it to a friend, Madame du Châtelet had her part in the work, in that she dictated and I wrote. Of course, all of Emily du Châtelet's work did not induce Voltaire to include her name in the title, although he did dedicate it to her and put her topless image inside the cover.
Yeah, it's a very nice piece of little art, I guess. You know, they went to some trouble to publish back then because, you know, it was kind of expensive, you know, no printing press yet and all that, so. But anyway, I guess they used wood carvings, you know, So a lot of work had to go into it, so a little extra huge amount of work, so what? But anyway, so only rich people could publish is the point. You know, you really had to have some purpose.
Cover as an angel. After the publication of that book, Voltaire started to work on a competition about the nature of fire and light, which Emily du Châtelet thought was dead wrong. Frustrated with Voltaire ignoring her ideas, Emily secretly wrote her own paper. She did.
So this is, you know, where you could just argue, you know, was she right or was she wrong? You know, and that's pretty much, I don't even think it's an open question, that she didn't have most of this understood right.
Determined that if a ray of light had any mass of...
So this is where it all goes to, frankly, hell, okay, is her own statement sort of proves that the theory of mv squared is rubbish. And instead of understanding that, oh yeah, I'm basically believing in something that creates a silly verse, she does the opposite and makes the rest of the universe silly. So, okay, so I could read some of this, right? But the effect of the force, see, I'll have to type this in because I can't, you can't get too many full quotes. So I don't know what book this is from. But the effect of the force of bodies being the product of their masses by the square of their speed, a ray that was only one, whatever this is, 2/1,000,000,000th part of a one lever cannonball. So she's trying to say something as small as what a beam of light would be in terms of its mass. Would have the same effect as the cannon, and a single instance of light would destroy all the universe, right? So if you give this whole idea that, just use the lever, and if I could make the infinite lever, I'm creating an infinite amount of energy at the end of the lever. The whole bullet nonsense. The gun has 2 joules. The bullet has 2,000 joules. So I just double that, and I got 4,000 to 4, and I just keep making more and more preposterous inequities. So she's basically now saying light can't have any mass because, if I give it mass, the kinetic energy formula says it has a preposterous amount of energy because I'm squaring the velocity. And so I'm doomed because the velocity is incredibly high. So we can't, you can see it right there. So instead of doing the obvious, what would be, this mv squared thing can't be right because the energies get insane. I just start moving lighter things faster and I keep making energy. I just want to make energy. I just cut the thing in half and make it go twice as fast and I'm making free energy. That doesn't make any sense. So it's just an illustration of this was a Benjamin Franklin moment. Now, they don't have to make this, it's not a 50-50 thing. Benjamin Franklin really had no reason to pick one side or the other at his time, which way the river flowed, the electricity was moving. He had no way to really detect that or know that. He didn't have enough information to make a decision. So, he just assigned plus and minus, guessed. This isn't a guess. So you can clearly see that they're forcing it to be right. They're not going in the direction of where's the pressure push you? Where do the fact pressures push? The fact pressures are saying, first of all, Newton, Descartes, and Galileo didn't believe in this mv squared thing. It's hostile to their physics. And on top of it, I've found that, if you think about it, it really doesn't make any sense because a little tiny photon of light would be, it could blow up the whole universe with its energy. So, maybe it's not the right answer. So instead of doing that, they doubled down and now created some notion that photons are magic now. They don't have any mass. So everything had mass in the universe. You couldn't really be a player in the universe if you had no mass. And now we have massless fun stuff. Big mistake.
All, then the speed of light would mean that, quote, an instant of light would, quote, destroy all the universe, and therefore light must have no mass. Emily du Châtelet also decided that fire, i.e. heat, was, quote, the cause of the...
So fire, i.e. heat. So I don't know, did they really think fire was heat? That every form of heat was a kind of fire? I don't know. But regardless, even if they did, that's pretty observant in a way. It's a reaction, and reactions have, by their very nature of the word reaction, there has to be action to have reaction. So therefore, they involve this energy transfer thing. All right, so we'll just read this little one. Thus, far from motion being the cause of fire, so obviously... The cause of fire is a chain reaction of motion where you trigger a bunch of events, that create expansions or contractions in chemistry, you could argue. So you're just forcing chemistry to expand or creating, you have little balloons and the balloons all burst, so to speak, and it creates more pressure because there's nothing holding the pressure, so the pressure expands. So you could argue that it's just about expansions. And the expansions happen in all directions, and that's why we call it heat, is because it's in all directions. If it's in one direction, like a laser beam, we don't call it heat. So when we can make the motion directional, then we call it something else. And when it's in the form of spreading in all directions, we call it heat. But it's just motion of little particles. Yeah. Not that that's their physics. I'm just pointing out that's the truth, frankly. You know, and whatever else they say is just another version of the wrong answer. All right. Cause of fire, as some philosophers thought, fire is, on the contrary, the cause of the internal motion of the particles of all bodies. So fire is, on the contrary, the cause. So, yeah, I mean, heat has to cause heat, but now we're right back to Descartes again. You know, there is no cause. There's just the effect of this stuff moving through the universe, the motion. Nothing causes the motion except motion. So, yeah, heat causes heat. You know, heat spreads. It goes places. But it can't stay and go. Can't be in two places at once. Well, see, that's what I would say. That's not what physics would say.
Internal motion of the particles of all bodies. And she even predicted the third law of thermodynamics 200...
Okay, so this is, you know, sort of on the pathetic side. But anyway, predicted.
Years before Walther Nernst, saying it was impossible that had a particle that was in, quote, perfect repose, and that, quote, all in nature is in perpetual oscillations of dilation and contraction caused by the action of fire.
So this is a decent idea, that it's just about this expansion and contraction, right? You're just compressing something by hitting it. You could argue, you know, the motion could be understood as motion this way is the same as motion that way, because any motion going this way requires there to be extra pressure going this way and reflection and blah, blah, blah. So you could understand it as just compressing something or letting something expand. And the trick is the expansions and compressions are always in both directions, technically. You know, and so that's why it's hard to take the heat out of a system, is because it's hard to force things to just go in the directions you want them to. You have to create insulators for all the other ways the heat could move. And the insulators would get really hot and they would melt, and that's not going to work. All right, anyway. All right, let's see. So far from being the subject to gravity, so she doesn't think fire is being subject to gravity, because she really doesn't understand its buoyancy in the atmosphere and all that. So this isn't exactly. Fire is antagonistic to it. Thus, all in nature is a perpetual oscillation of dilation and contraction caused by the action of fire on bodies. So it isn't. Obviously, everything's nuclear, so, you know, you could argue that everything could be reduced to being just heat moving in a direction, like the laser beam and everything else. The little bits are going to transfer their energy to each other with little bits. The pressure is going to be made out of electrons and protons hitting each other and moving. So on the smallest level, the universe is just made out of electrons and protons, you could argue, and the energy pushing them about, and there's nothing else. So it's, you know, a reasonable statement, you know, that far. Taking it any further is the dangerous part. All right, well, anyway, fire on bodies and the reaction of the bodies in the opposite that oppose the action of the fire by their weight and their cohesion of their particles. So that's a more interesting statement almost. The whole idea of whether there is any actual reaction or there's just the actual consumption of your fire. So, I don't need something to take away my money if I gave it away. So if I give my money away, I give the heat away, I don't need an opposite force to make me cold. So when I give away my pressure, that is when I expand, I don't need something to make me contract. You know, because I've already lost my pressure. I push something out. That means I don't have any more pushing pressure. So I'm going to get compressed. So the opposite reaction is just a consequence of giving away what you had. All right. On the bodies, and we do not know of any perfectly hard bodies because we do not know any that does not contain fire, and the particles of which are in perfect repose. So the fact that we don't see anything doesn't mean anything. The fact is, look, we look like we're reposed in gravity. We look like we're sitting here doing nothing, not moving. But you can know you're moving because you can feel the constant pressure of the earth pushing you back up. It can't push you back up if you don't go down first. So we're really oscillating in the gravity, technically. But there's no reason to speculate that someplace in the universe there can't be some bit of matter that's just sitting there. But I would argue if you understand the energy in the universe, you'd understand that it can't sit there very long, that it's going to be constantly just moved around in the artificial randomness of the entire universe. But anyway, the point is that, you know, this is just going more precisely to Descartes' point that whatever in the universe is all there is in the universe, that it already has its motion in it. And all you're doing is watching the motion go from one place to another. Nothing else. Thus, the ancient philosophers who denied absolute rest were surely more, severe, perhaps without knowing it, than those who denied motion. So I don't think it's a big point to make. You know, the imagination of some idea of irrelevant motion, you could argue. I mean, motionless for the sake of an argument. You know, I mean, jiggling back and forth, you could argue, can't be compared to actually going somewhere. So objects actually going somewhere have a bias in their energy. They have more of it going one way than another way. A school of fish standing in one place is distinctly, you know, observably different than a school of fish moving in a direction. You can calculate and argue that the fish of the school is moving has more fish moving in this direction more time, and the school that isn't moving means it has just as much fish going this way as it has fish going that way. All right.
Neither Voltaire nor Emily du Châtelet won the contest, nor even got honorable mention. But her reputation...
These contests were pretty cruddy, frankly. So they did these different contests. They actually had a contest for MV squared. And they disqualified an entry because it didn't believe in MV squared. So, I mean, you know, it is kind of pitiful. The level of the standards of the physics was pretty bad. There was no jury here. There was no established... there was no go-to physics place where you could go to the authorities and get right answers. They were still making the right answers, and there was, you know, pretty big conflict over what right answers would look like. I mean, people had pretty diverse opinions. So where do you go? It's like if you have a Darwinist and a religious kook. I mean, what authority do you go to say, you know, who's right and who's wrong? Now, you could argue that you could go to a jury of rational people who think you should have evidence, or you could go to a jury of people who think, well, evidence, you know. Is it a nice story?
Patient as a serious scientist was made. Her gossipy neighbor wrote, "I read the dissertation on fire that Madame wrote. It is so clear, so precise. I apologize to Monsieur de Voltaire, but it's much better than his. And when did she write this discourse? At night, because she was hiding from Voltaire." While researching how destructive sunlight could be if it had mass, she started...
So again, it's just, you know, it's just kind of silly, right? I mean, you're just saying that they had the right idea. They kind of knew that light was, you know, banging into things and causing trouble. And so why would you even imagine that I'm just going to separate it and say it's not like all the other stuff, it's not doing what all the other stuff is doing, which is banging into things? Yeah, just big mistake. I mean, so I'm just saying this is a big mistake moment in history where the idea of velocity having to have a mass Now they've just completely broken the physics by saying somehow we're gonna have something that's a massless motivator, and there's just no point in creating this hobgoblin.
To study what different scientists said about the destructive effect of moving objects with mass. And having just written a book on Newton, she was up to date on Newton's theories. However, despite what I was told in school, Newton never wrote the...
So I love that she threw this in there, but she should have said it with more context. She should have pointed out that this was made up in like 1815 or something. That this wasn't part of physics, this wasn't any kind of notion, and it was a bizarre derivation of Newton's simple mechanics, which was basically to say force equals the change in your momentum. That's what Newton said. Force equals the change in your momentum. You change your momentum, whatever your momentum changes by, that's the force. And frankly, I think Newton would argue that force is indistinguishable from energy. So energy is force, is momentum. All right, and then you can go to this new concept of work, and you could argue that clearly, yes, work is also just the same stuff. Now, I might argue that work is only half, okay, because we can only steal from the explosion half of the explosion. You know, we have to stand on one side of it and get pushed this way, or we stand on this side of it and get pushed that way. What we don't have is a capacity to capture energy from both sides. We can't take back the force it takes to push into the ground to make the horse go forward, the hoof. We can't get back the part that crushed the ground and moved it. We can't get back that pressure. We can only get the forward motion part. So we're only getting half of the explosion, so to speak, the expansion.
Force equals mass times acceleration. In fact, the closest he ever came to it was, quote...
So I like, this is good that this is pointed out, but people, it doesn't matter, right? So this is sort of an important idea that everybody is misinformed in this preposterous way that this is Newtonian physics. MV squared is Newtonian physics. Kinetic energy is Newtonian physics. It's completely not Newtonian physics. He opposed it. He had no reason to believe in it because he got right answers already. He didn't need a new formula. He didn't need to correct himself because he wasn't getting wrong answers. So that's the silly part of this. This, like I said, this wasn't a mistake like plus and minus. This was like an overt tragedy of people with an agenda rewriting history. And that's, they literally rewrote the history and put that garbage in Newton's head and mouth. Which is really a horrible offense. You're not standing on the shoulders of giants, you're stomping on the shoulders of giants. And then pissing on their grave. Okay, a change in motion is proportional to the motive force impressed. So it's that's his formula. F equals the change in your momentum. He's saying it overtly right there. I mean, proportional is, he's basically saying equal. You want to know, something's moving and you want to know what the force was? Well, you just figure out how much did it move and how heavy is it? There, we're done. It worked. So all, like I said, Galileo, Descartes, and Newton were famous because they got right answers. They're not famous because they got a bunch of wrong answers. And the mechanism they used, the idea they used, you've decided to completely throw in the garbage for this new modern version that says preposterous things like a beam of light will explode the universe. To accept a theory that just, it can't even survive the lever test. The lever becomes a free energy device and you still cling to it. I mean, it really is an amazingly horrible, awful tragedy in terms of the intelligence of humankind and just how broken it was by completely, kind of inexcusable mistakes. Again, to call them mistakes is to not tell the truth. Leibniz was a religious nut. She's not talking about him, but he invented this crap. Okay, and Deschardelet was a crystal rubbing, you know, hope theorist, okay? And she only clung to it because it provided interesting magic in the universe.
A change in motion is proportional to motive force impressed. Instead, Newton and the French scientist Descartes were much more focused on the mass times the speed.
And so why don't you just point out, and that's how they got right answers. They got a lot of right answers by focusing on just mass and velocity and not thinking there's any reason to distort or pervert either one of those things. That they, quite obviously, it was just about little m's and big v's, or big v's and little m's. And you just added up how much the mv weighs and the amount of mv you have in total, and you have an answer for how much capacity the thing has to create pressure in the universe, to push on things, to move other stuff. You have defined its quantity of motion, okay, its energy. And you don't need anything else. This works. This will tell you when Halley's Comet will show up. It'll tell you a whole bunch of stuff. You don't need anything else. So she should just, in here, she should be pointing out how, gee, you know, they got right answers with this MV thing. And de Chatelet is already pointing out how, well, I have to blow up a whole bunch of other theory, you know, like things have to be material, or they can't be in the material universe. You know, they can't really be something in the universe if they're made out of nothing. You know, the nothing theory. So instead of just accepting this, they said, no, let's tie a hobgoblin over here and a pixie in front of it. We'll put pixies and hobgoblins in the story. For no good reason. I could just say Jesus and the Holy Ghost, right? Jesus would be the little square and the Holy Ghost would be the half. But that's all it is. All right, I'll leave that image up for a minute and take a pause. Anyway. All right, I could add at this point that MV is, you know, can also be understood as weight. That you could just simply say your mass is a certain amount, okay, whatever your weight is in gravity, sitting in gravity, your weight, okay? So, you know, you can step on a scale and it'll tell you your mass. You know, your weight and your mass will be the same number because you could argue velocity is one in gravity. And now every way you move you in some other way. So if I did the same thing to you, if I took your mass and I moved it with 1 meter per second velocity into a scale sideways. So here's your mass, and I move it 1 meter per second into a scale. You weigh the same as your mass. You weigh the same as you weigh on the ground. So, I mean, it can be understood as an equity, and that every time you add any velocity, I add to that 1 meter per second a little bit extra, well, then you could weigh, you know, 1.5 times your mass. If I add a little more, you weigh 2 times your mass. So if I go twice, you know, two meters per second, then that velocity will mean your weight will be double. And so you just keep adding it based on your velocity. Your velocity is your weight, you know, in a sense. Whatever I do to your velocity, I increase that your mass's weight with that increase. And, you know, it can be understood that simply. So let's understand, like, Newton and Descartes and Galileo all probably, you know, I throw Galileo in because he pretty much knew everything ahead of time. 10-ton train going 5 miles an hour, same thing as, you know, 5-ton stagecoach or whatever, you know. And the only place this gets tricky is with, ballistics or something. You know, the idea that people realized it with cannons, right? I mean, the recoil of a cannon was tremendous. You know, they had to nail the thing down, tie ropes on it so it could move a little bit because they had to do something with the energy. Because the energy was so much energy in the cannon after it fired a cannonball that if they just nailed it down, it would break all the boards in the boat. You know, it would ruin your boat. So, you had to nail the thing down and you had to give it some ability to move. To dispense the energy, you had to give it velocity, you had to allow it to absorb some of the energy by actually moving, or you were going to tear the boat to pieces, shoot your cannonball. So, you know, that wasn't, it seemed equitable. The amount of energy in the ball is equal to the amount of energy in the cannon. Now, the gun and the bullet, that's where it kind of gets lost a little, because, yes, the bullet's always going to look more impressive than the gun. But it doesn't change the elemental fact, you know, that they don't. There's no disproportion in energy. The bullet has the same energy. It's just 1,000 times fewer atoms going 1,000 times faster, you know, and the gun is 1,000 times more atoms going 1,000 times slower. But MV works. It works in the world. There was no, just make sure it's understood, there was no apparent problem. There was no obvious, MV can't be right because of this obvious problem created. And the problem was, it didn't exist. And the other side of the story, the problem does exist in the sense that now photons will blow up the universe with MV squared. So they had obvious good reason to stick with the MV and really good reasons to avoid the MV squared. And again, the simple lever arguments were made back then that, you know, a lever is a free energy device if you use MV squared. And all of that was ignored, okay, to believe in the religion, the gods, the gremlins, the energy gremlins.
As if two objects collide with identical mass time speed and stuck to each other, they would stop moving. And for this reason, some people start to call mass time speed the dead force.
Again, some people, you know, whoever those people would be. Obviously, they figured out there was this idea of the chemical energy and the energy that seemed, you know, all of a sudden to blow up, you know, explosives and stuff like that. So obviously, you could have energy in some little package and somehow it was benign, you know, versus the energy that is actively moving other stuff. It's actually doing the transfer thing. So there's energy not being transferred, contained, not going somewhere else, just bouncing around inside its little box. And then there's energy actively exchanging. That is forcing one thing to hit another thing, to hit another thing, it's moving. So there's energy on the move that is outside of a system. And then there's energy trapped in the system. So you can even go back to the first nuclear energy kind of drawings, you know, with this idea of this motion, circular motion trapped inside of the little atom. It's a wrong drawing. It's a wrong concept. But the idea of the trap, you know, that it's just bouncing back and forth, it's stuck inside of a box, is a perfectly rational way to say this. You know, when the energy is bouncing back and forth, it's stuck, it's trapped, it's a cul-de-sac, the car's spinning around circles, you know, and the active, when it finally finds the exit and starts going back out into the world, then it's going to be active energy. It's going somewhere, creating distance, creating movement, creating pressure, creating all that kind of stuff.
Emily du Châtelet wasn't limited to Newton or Descartes. See, at the time, science was a bit of a nationalistic pastime.
Okay, so yeah, well, that's always been true, might still be true. Who cares? That's really not the story, okay? This wasn't about any kind of nationalism. And it really wasn't, because you could argue that Leibniz took his theory from Huygens. And, you know, because Huygens figured out, well, you know, it's not that complicated, right? You can use a square when you're doing circles to do circumferences and all that kind of stuff, right? Because the radius squared, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, so angular momentum, you could understand there might be a square involved. But this, you know, there's no reason to abstract that special case into the common case of straight line force. But anyway, so I don't want to get too deep into that. So this is as much as she's going to pay attention to Leibniz, the guy who invented this crap. And he invented it solely for one reason, because he thought Descartes' physics was too atheist. The idea, it offended him. Descartes basically argued that God has initiated the universe and given it to us, and it's us to us to make energy shields to, you know, make the energy move in the right ways, you know, our spiritual energy or whatever you want to call it, you know, all the you know, the universe is ours to play with, but he's not going to stick his fingers in any other way than miracles or something. I don't, you know, whatever. There's this no, the universe is a rolling ball. It's already in motion. God doesn't keep pushing it. And Leibniz found that really offensive because he's basically saying every single event in the universe is part of God's fun to play with, and he's constantly involved and blah, blah, blah. So it was basically an objection based on the facts that Leibniz was a religious kook, a fanatic, and he didn't like physics that described a universe that wasn't directly connected to creation theory. So it's just creation science now shoved right in there, right? You know, Newton and Descartes were both religious kooks because, you know, people didn't have much choice back then. But they clearly saw the physics as being separate from that story in terms of just understanding the mechanics God is using to create the world. That description didn't need to have God's intent anywhere in it, where Leibniz thought God's perfection should be in the design somewhere. Leibniz is famous for saying silly things like, it's a perfect world. You know, even though people were dying of the plague, you know, it's a perfect world. So, yeah.
If you are English, you need to support Newton. If you are German, Leibniz. If you are French, Descartes.
Let's understand, even the Germans didn't show up for Leibniz's funeral. Okay, so he didn't win this argument. The argument was, so MV versus MV squared, Newton decisively wins. Descartes decisively wins. Okay, Leibniz dies nobody. Nobody in England, nobody in Germany, nobody in France. Okay, nobody cared. So just understand, he didn't win this argument. And he also didn't fare too well because, you know, he got accused of stealing Newton's calculus and, you know, he forged dates on letters, you know. Guilty of lots of little crimes against things you would call integrity.
Often to the exclusion of others. Emily thought this was ridiculous and wrote, about a book of physics, one must ask if it is good, not if the author is English, German, or French, or as Voltaire.
So, I mean, that's just so imbecilically, trivially, like every person should be able to figure that out, that, you know, there's no, you know, they didn't know what genetics was, but I mean, clearly there's no reason to believe that, you know, they can only do good science in some geographic location. I mean, that would be really stupid.
Ugh. Put it, quote, in the kingdom of Madame du Châtelet, there is an absolute freedom of conscience. In 1738 or so, Emily du Châtelet learned that Newton's rival, Gottfried Leibniz, had proposed something that he called the living force that was dependent.
So I don't know if it was that late. 1938 is only a couple years before she died. So I'm not too sure that she didn't say something. I mean, she already wrote about fire, right? I don't know when the fire contest was much earlier. Clearly, she was already believed in MV squared. So this chain can't possibly be correct, okay? This chain of the history can't be right because the whole reason why she was arguing about the heat, you know, was the argument that the light is MV squared and that's why it has to be a non-massive particle.
On the mass times the velocity squared, which was conserved when objects bounced off each other. Living because this quote-unquote force was only conserved for moving objects.
All right, so even this doesn't make any sense. How do you conserve it if nothing's moving? You know, you can't even do a transfer if nothing's moving. So what does that even mean? It doesn't mean anything. It's just mush. So, you know, it's not conserved with a lever. So again, this simple frickin' lever already proves it's not conserved. So why are you even talking about these people having any belief in energy conservation? Because a lever is not energy conservation by their definition. It fails the lever test. I mean, can it be a simpler test to fail? Levers don't create energy and they don't destroy energy. All they can do is convert energy. You cannot make more kinetic energy on one end of the lever than you put in on the other end of the lever. You can't do it. Their theory says you can. Obviously you can't. Obviously it's wrong.
Newton and Leibniz were enemies from their days where they argued about who discovered calculus.
Right, but that's really not how it happened, right? So, they didn't argue about mv squared either, and it only became part of the subject. Leibniz didn't win with this. He proposed mv squared and crickets, okay? Nobody cared much, okay? Because, yeah, Newton got right answers with mv, and there was just no reason to jump on this Leibniz boat. He had no reasoning for proposing it. There wasn't any great argument. I mean, this the silly gravity thing. Well, it goes four times higher. Their term says four times as much energy. And they already knew that, well, it only lands with twice the velocity. So, because it's only in the gravity half as long. The four times the distance isn't how long it's in the gravity. So, I mean, Galileo already did that with the slope. I mean, the whole reason why Galileo rolled things down a slope was because it was hard to watch them, in real motion. So he had slowed them down. And it makes it really kind of clear that it goes only this distance, and then it goes this distance, and then it goes this distance in 1 second. So clearly, how much distance it goes in a second is completely variable. But how much energy it absorbed in that second is the same. So even though it went this far, it only absorbed the same amount of gravitational energy in that gigantic distance. Because it's just about the time you're in the gravity.
And almost everyone in Europe was firmly in one camp or the other.
No, there weren't anybody in Leibniz's camp. Let's just understand. Of course, there were some people that would defend him, but there was no giant population that was MV squareders. It didn't work. The argument was so weak. It was so easily defeated. The lever defeated it. The photon defeated it. It wasn't a winning argument in any way. So, there's no camp, and somehow this woman, publishing bullshit, was able to snooker everybody. She showed up with a faro cell. She did some clay experiments and sand experiments, and she used a little bit of convoluted reasoning to argue that we should be impressed by these measuring tools, and they could be understood to be flawed measuring tools. They're crooked rulers. They're not going to give you the right answer. And everybody got fooled.
However, Emily felt differently, telling her son, quote, "Do not carry respect for the greatest men to the point of idolatry. No book is so good."
So, yeah, and then what is this, though, right? So it's just woman idolatry now. Remarkable woman, no flaws at all. Just please.
That one might not improve it. Now, one of the definitive ex
So again, we just, you have to say that this is part of her crystally vision of the world in a sense, right? That no, there's some points where you've perfected something. You've perfected a story, you've perfected a play, you perfect a movie. There's no point in changing anything because it works just fine. I mean, those are probably bad examples because they're so subjective, but I just mean the round wheel kind of thing. You have it round enough. This idea that there's always some necessity to find something else to polish or perfect, not necessarily so. MV worked really well, and there was no reason to sit there and try to file it into some other shape or glue anything to it. It worked.
Experiments that convinced Emily du Châtelet that the damage of a moving object depended on the speed squared.
Right, the damage on a moving object, right? And this doesn't mean anything. Because we know the damage depends on how you apportion the energy. If I take the laser beam and point it at you and burn a hole in you, or I just take the light bulb and spread the photons over your whole surface, I can hit you with the same number of photons. It's just how I hit them on you, how they're imposed upon you. And we know that, yes, fast things can release their energy quickly. So lots of energy quickly released, quickly transferred. I have, if I have to go to the bank to convert the money into singles and then throw the singles, it's a direct. In one form I can directly transfer. In another form, it takes time to transfer because I have to stick each bill in somebody's hand. If I want to give away $10,000, if I just give it away as a $10,000 bill, I'm done really quick. If I have to give it away as $1 bills, it's going to take me a while to get rid of it. These rules mean that it's going to affect us differently. So this idea of damage being a way of detecting how much energy there is, the word damage doesn't mean anything because it has all so many forms. The damage can be big pieces flying off slow, or it can be little pieces flying off fast. But it really won't change anything. So things can look different, but looking different isn't being different. The bullet looks different than the gun. They look different, but there's no difference in how much atoms they're moving.
Times the mass, or the living force.
So again, that's another part of this. I mean, isn't that just a giveaway? You know, the living force? That's even back then, I wonder how many people said, gee, that doesn't sound very scientific. You know, that sounds kind of, you know, religious. All right, I think I'll take another pause. Well, that's not a very good face to end up with.
Dramatized by the 2005 documentary, Einstein's Big Idea.
Okay, which is a nice documentary. Again, nice show, but just awful history. So, you know, so well dramatized. She has to point out that this is Emily. You know, that's like telling somebody they need to subscribe and ring the bell or something. That is a little bit funny. Is the bell still there? Oh, yeah, it is. Oh, it's just so funny.
Graph sound in Leiden
so
has been
I have
dropping
to say
lead balls into a pan.
That this woman was really quite, she was good. Me likey. But anyway, we'll get to that later. So, till later. I mean, it won't be that much later for you. It's one of those whole things, right? It looks like it took a long time to me. But it won't take very long to you. All right, should be back. So I guess we'll play the little dramatic reconstruction, and then we'll call this part one and such.
Of clay.
Dropping lead balls into clay are very imaginative.
Using Newton's formulas, Monsieur Voltaire, he then drops a second ball from a higher height, calculated to...
So calculated, right? So it's calculated because, you know, it's four times higher to double the velocity. So all you're saying is yes, it'll only be in the gravity twice as long. So the calculation is, well, how do I get it into the gravity twice as long? Well, I put it four times higher because its higher velocity means it's going to travel the distance quicker, and therefore it will only be in the gravity twice as long. So this is also proving a gravitational theory, in the sense that the obvious part of the theory is that gravity, you know, especially back then, they still had the option. You know, they weren't so warped by all of this space warping gibberish. So they still had good reason to think gravity was an active force raining on us. And the simple, obvious conclusion, the explanation for why you have to go four times higher is because you're in the rain only twice as much. So you go four times the distance because technically you're only going to be in the rain twice as long because of your extra speed. Okay, so there is no paradoxical strangeness to the idea you have to go four times higher to go twice as fast to double your energy. It's not four times the energy, it's only double the energy. All right, and so she's proving the backward theory. Go backwards. So, you know, gravity isn't a real force. It isn't about how long you're in it. All of this deconstruction of a material universe into an immaterial universe. So, you know, it's appropriate that they put this in the Einstein video, because this is the first bad thought you have to have. This is where you break the universe so you can break it some more with the rest of the little warping of reality. You need to crack it before you can break it. This is the crack.
Exactly double the speed of the first ball on impact. So, monsieur, care for a little wager?
So, clay. So, you know, Brozo couldn't duplicate these results, so just point that out. But it all just has to do with the mixture of your clay. You change how you mix your clay, you're going to change how sticky it is, and how much it's going to adhere to objects, and how much it's going to move in a direction, and all of that crap. And this is just a friction argument. The different things have different friction coefficients. So you use a substance that gives you the answer you want. you mix it to a thickness that gives you the answer you want. So if she had believed that it was m squared v, then she could just do cornstarch experiments and prove that. So this is where experimental science goes, you know, flushed, because it just becomes about how you do an experiment, you know, how you manipulate the conditions. And it becomes ferrocell science, you know, where you just show something. Look, the light's bent. And you don't really explain it. So the explanation of how the ruler works is ignored, okay? And we just say it's a ruler and it's accurate. When if you did the physics, you'd know that the clay isn't accurate, that it yields to fast things and it doesn't yield to slow things, that like our skin, it cheats the truth. Fast things go through, slow things don't.
Newton tells us that by doubling the speed of the ball, we will double the distance it travels into the clay. Leibniz...
It has double the energy. So again, and again, that's not necessarily just about distance. It's only about distance when you're measuring it based on its velocity. And velocity is dependent on in which medium it has to travel through. So if it's through the atmosphere, you have a certain friction coefficient, right? And it ironically gets much stronger the faster you go. The friction gets onerous. And that's why you have such a thing as a terminal velocity. And you can't go any faster applying the same amount of force because it piles up the amount of force applied against you. The atmosphere thickens as you push into it. So there's rules for each one. They all have a different rule, okay? Land friction, the faster you go, the less friction there is.
Asks us to square that speed. If he is correct, the ball will travel not two, but four times as far. So, who is correct?
Right, and four times representing the four times the distance. But obviously we already know that it's not four times the distance doesn't mean anything if you understand gravity is a force you collect by how much time you're moving in it. And it's kind of obvious that that's what it's doing, you know, in the sense that if I hold my hand here, I can feel that I have to keep applying a force against it. I have to keep pushing against the gravity.
Monsieur, I feel Mr. Newton's reputation dwindling ever so slightly.
Oh. Right, so that's the exact bullshit attitude, I guess, right? I guess a whole bunch of people wanted to tear down the icon. So 20 years after Newton's death, they're already trying to rip him an asshole for no good reason. They're trying to escape the tyranny of his philosophy or something. I mean, it's just pretty pitiful. But the real point is that it's just a publishing industry. And so the propaganda gets published. Everybody reads the propaganda and no other thoughts are entered into. And it just becomes some sort of, you know, traditional notion. And it's a silly notion. It didn't have any... didn't mean anything when it was said.
Oh, mon père, oui, do not succumb to her. There is no earthly reason to ascribe hidden forces to this Dutchman's lead ball.
Oh, that's annoying.
Is work piling up on you? Don't get destroyed by messy problems.
Well, the ball travels four times further.
Anyway,
okay, anyway. So that's an anyway. So you just throw an anyway. So this is the experiment. This is all you get as evidence. So the lever proves it can't possibly be true. Okay, lots of gravitational experiments prove it can't possibly be true. It doesn't really have four times the energy. Okay, so I mean, even Galileo probably did some experiments like, you know, where he puts a bunch of blocks that the rolling ball plows into. So there's lots of experiments that demonstrate that, no, I don't get four times. The gravity only creates twice the energy. You know, the pendulum only has twice the energy from falling that distance, and it just depends on what you crash it into. So they decide to crash it into clay and say, that's the definition of the proper ruler to measure energy. And obviously, again, it can be understood just like land friction can be understood. The faster you're going, the less contact you have with the ground because you're starting to create an orbit. You're starting to orbit the Earth. You know, and So you have less capacity to lose your energy to friction.
In 1740, Emily du Châtelet published a book called Lessons in Physics, which was the first to champion Newton's theories and the idea of a living force, and helped promote both Newton's and Leibniz's theories.
Okay, so they really can't be both promoted in some kind of ways, right? So she couldn't deny that Newton got right answers, and she just footnoted the book with Leibniz's, you know, wishy-washy mush crap physics, and I'm sure she didn't provide in any of the counter arguments that point out, well, it doesn't work. If you do a simple diagram of a lever, you can understand that levers are free energy devices now, and we can all have free energy. I mean, it's just a fact. I mean, lift a heavy rock, drop it on one end of the lever, put a light rock, a half-mass rock, twice as far on the other side of the lever, and I got free energy. I just doubled my energy. It's that bad. All right, so we'll call this a video. Yes, it's an hour. So maybe it'll take three parts. Who knows? This is, like, important because it is all about just the propaganda, the stories people tell. And the stories are not the truth, and they're not really what happened, and blah, 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 blah. And it's just unfortunate that this is how the wooers defend the woo, is by rewriting the woo history. And so instead of acknowledging that they're just creationists, you know, because they're basically just accepting the silly ideas of a guy who believed in solitons and monads, you know, spiritual entities were the cause of energy and movement. Little ghosts pushed things. That was his theory. That's the guy you're building your physics on. The you know. So sorry, but that's ugly. That's not a great part of your history, and you're covering it up. And that's the simple truth. All right, so till the next time and such, and so forth and whatnot. This has been draftphysics.com and debatephysics.com also, but there's nothing to debate, right? Because I am right, and nobody can change that truth. So it is kind of funny. They really can't make a counter-argument on the subject at all. Yeah, I win.